This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, sitting in for Joshua Johnson in Washington. Sloth selfies, elephant rides, tiger hangouts, dolphin swims. These are just some of the attractions offered by the wildlife tourism industry, and they've become so popular these days, they're nearly synonymous with contemporary travel. The industry isn't new, but thanks to social media platforms like Instagram and Facebook, these activities are more visible and marketable than ever before. Wildlife tourism allows visitors to enjoy animals up close in their natural habitats. But what happens when you take an even closer look at the industry? Are the animals enjoying themselves too? At what cost to animals is business booming? Here with me in studio is Natasha Daly, a writer and editor for National Geographic, covering animal welfare and exploitation. She's the reporter behind Nat Geo's June cover story about wildlife tourism behind the scenes. Natasha, welcome to 1A.
Thanks, Sasha, for having me.
Later on in the hour, we'll speak with conservationist and wildlife photographer Carl Amon about another issue that's endangering wildlife, the tiger trade. But first, let's dig into Natasha's reporting. First things first, Natasha, what do we mean when we talk about wildlife tourism? Talk about the wide array of experiences that this includes.
Right. So wildlife tourism really can run the gamut from going into the forest with binoculars looking for birds to going on safari to having these up close experiences with exotic animals. So it really does run. There's a vast spectrum that it covers.
And now you made a short documentary that showcases some of what you found while traveling and researching this story. Here's a piece of that documentary.
Jesus. We came behind the stadium where the elephants perform, and we found this juvenile elephant. He has a gaping red wound at his temple. He also has a broken leg. The other one is chained up. He looks totally emaciated, skin and bones. And this is the worst shape I've seen an elephant in Thailand. All in the name of entertainment.
Wow, I have to say, I watched that earlier, and as we were just discussing, it was a lot.
Yes, being there in person was extremely difficult. So just a little background on our story. So photographer Kirsten Luce and I traveled around the world over the course of about a year looking at various hotspots where this industry is thriving. And that clip you just heard was from a elephant attraction outside of Bangkok, Thailand. And we found this juvenile elephant behind a stadium.
Give us an overview of where all you went to.
Right. So we traveled. We really wanted to go to hotspots around the world where this up close, these up-close encounters with captive wildlife are thriving. So we went to Thailand. We were there for about a month. We went to Russia. We went to Hawaii. And where this all started to rewind was actually in the Amazon rainforest, where we were looking at these experiences with sloths, caimans, anacondas, etc.
That's what I was just going to ask you. What kinds of wildlife tourism did you encounter along the way?
Right. So we were really looking at native species in each place we went. So, and the reason we were doing that is because, for example, you may go to Thailand as a traveler, and something that's kind of often at the top of people's bucket list is wanting to get close to an elephant or a tiger. So we really want to look at animals native to the countries where we were traveling to see how they're used for these unique wildlife experiences.
Laura tweeted, she says, "We went on our honeymoon to Thailand with visions of riding an elephant. Upon arrival, we were warned of the horrific condition used to break the elephants and opted to visit a sanctuary instead, where we could feed the elephants and give them a bath. It was more expensive, but far more humane."
Right.
Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that this is increasingly, I mean, first of all, to back up a little bit, what I think Laura is describing is a process that is pretty universal based on what we found in our reporting. So in order for an elephant, for example, to be docile enough to interact with humans up close, to give those rides or even give those baths or perform tricks, they have to be trained from a young age. And so we encountered hundreds of elephants through our time in Thailand and spoke to trainers, et cetera. And typically what happens when the elephant is young is that the elephant is separated from its mother and that it is slowly trained using an instrument called a bull hook, which is a wooden stick with a metal hook on the end, to comply, to sit, to stand, to do tricks, and essentially to be able to obey the owner. So I think that's what Laura's describing, what she heard about before she went there. And maybe she didn't realize before she went that this is prolific throughout the industry.
Can you describe a bit more about the conditions that you found upon your travels? And tell us, what kind of responses do tourists get when they actually ask these attraction owners about the living conditions of the animals? I know Laura, she says she was warned, but sometimes people ask.
Right. So in terms of the living conditions that we encountered, so in large part, I would say what we'd often find is that elephants at these elephant camps are confined in stalls when they're not out giving rides or performing. Usually they'll have a chain around their ankle, be attached to a pole, and they don't really have an ability to move very much. Typically, they won't really get to have other interaction with elephants. Elephants are very social, so not being able to have that interaction can be a red flag. So these are just some examples of the conditions that we would see repeatedly while on our travels.
And how did seeing all of it make you feel?
To be honest, it was difficult to see. I think that it was not everything we saw was as horrific as the clip you just heard. There was absolutely a spectrum, and, you know, some days were easier than others. There were times that Kirsten and I would see a specific situation and truly be blown away by it and be very saddened by what we are seeing. And then there were other times that we realized, you know, okay, this is not nearly as concerning as maybe what we saw yesterday. And I think that really represents the industry as a whole. There is not kind of one size fits all situation that each elephant is in, but overall, they're all largely part of this industry where they are trained for the most part at a young age to have these experiences.
Let's go to another clip from your documentary.
We went to Elephant Valley in Chiang Rai, Thailand. They have elephants that have been rescued from the traditional industry, and tourists are not allowed to get close to the elephants.
This is probably the only interaction that tourists will get while they're here. It's snack time, so they're able to feed each of the elephants some bananas. And you can see this barrier is there mostly for to prevent people from going into the elephant grounds. So it's totally voluntary. The elephants come for snack time, and then they can leave whenever they want. So it's a sustainable option for elephant tourism in the area.
So, Natasha, these attractions are technically legal, right? You know, what kind of action can be taken either on the part of the industry or on the part of the consumers?
Yes. So I think it's really important to know that everything that's going on in Thailand with elephants and tigers, et cetera, these are all legal activities.
They are all legal.
Yes, yes. Everything that's happening that we described that you just heard are above board and legal and, you know, authorized by the government.
Nothing is wrong with what is happening.
Right, exactly.
Interesting. Now, we mentioned earlier the role of social media in popularizing these attractions. I know I, for one, have been dying to go to Thailand, and I'm thinking, oh, wow, the first thing I want to do is take photos with the elephants because that's what everyone does on my Instagram feed. But what else has changed about the industry, if anything, that's exacerbated the issue of ethics here?
Yes. So I think what you describe is actually a really common desire. People love animals. They want to get close to them. You go to Thailand, and absolutely one of the things most people want to do, based on a year of reporting, talking to dozens of tourists, is get close to an elephant. So I think that yes, this is exacerbated by the fact that, I mean, first of all, these activities are nothing new. This is not something that's popped up in the last few years by any means. But what really has changed the game is social media. So just as you describe, you may be scrolling idly through your Instagram feed, see a friend or even just, you know, a celebrity or influencer that you may follow having this beautiful, picturesque experience with an elephant. And you might think, wow, I really want to do that as well. So what social media functions as is essentially viral advertising, intentionally or not, for these experiences.
Zuzu wrote on our Facebook page, please stop riding elephants and camels, swimming with dolphins, taking photos with any animal. You are participating in and funding their abuse.
Right. So I think that the key thing here is that most people do not want to hurt an animal. Most people do not want to think that they're contributing to any sort of abuse. So what I think is important to remember is that it's extremely important to do your homework, to do your research. If you don't want to think that you may be contributing to these activities, then you really want to research ahead of time what you're getting into before you pay your money at the door to buy a ticket, but also before maybe you post it to social media and recommend it to your friends and family.
You wrote in your reporting that you're most concerned about elephants and tigers. Why?
Right. I think the nature of the elephant and tiger industry in Thailand, and I keep bringing up Thailand because it's where we reported from for so long, is a massive part of the tourist economy. So there are about 3,800 captive elephants in Thailand, and a huge majority of them are part of the tourism industry. And they're so popular and remain so popular that these experiences are something that is a huge sort of dimension of this wildlife tourism industry. Tigers, I'm glad you brought them up because there are two kind of very popular experiences with tigers while in Thailand. One is snuggling a tiger cub up close. You'll go to a facility, you'll have a baby tiger, you'll be able to cuddle it for 5 minutes and then sort of move on. Another really popular activity is posing with adult tiger cubs, like right next to them, getting your photo taken. But what people may not realize is that tiger cubs are often speed bred for this industry, which means their mothers are bred over and over. They're taken from their mothers shortly after birth. And tigers are only little for so long.
Right.
So in order to always have new baby tigers to cuddle, a business will have to always have new baby tigers. So I think that that's maybe something people don't realize by just going for a few hours.
Coming up, we'll discuss tips for ethical animal encounters on vacation. We're speaking with Natasha Daly, writer and editor for National Geographic. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We're discussing wildlife tourism with Natasha Daly of National Geographic. Natasha, not all of what you saw in your travels was necessarily grim or unethical. Talk about animal sanctuaries and other more ethical attractions.
Right. So the sanctuary sort of movement is something that has really grown in Thailand over the last few years. And largely this has come from tourist demand. I think it's important to note here that this entire industry is driven by consumer demand, by consumer dollars. So as people start to demand different experiences or want different things, the industry does follow. And so what you've been seeing in the last decade or so is that many tourists have been increasingly aware that there are issues going on in this industry. And they've been seeking out more natural, more humane experiences. And the market has followed. So over the last several years in Thailand, you have seen a opening of places that call themselves elephant sanctuaries. And this is, you know, there's absolutely a spectrum. And these sanctuaries are in large part vastly more humane than elephant attractions where the elephants give rides all day or do tricks. There are some issues involved in this is that, you know, often people may do a Google search for elephant sanctuary. You may come across a website. It says we're an elephant sanctuary. We don't offer any riding. But then you may get there and they may offer an activity that still relies on interaction like bathing, for example. So while this is in many ways an improvement in terms of the elephant's day-to-day life, it may still raise red flags because as long as that up-close interaction exists, that elephant will have to have been trained in order to stand next to you. So I think that these are red flags that the industry is still working through, and it's important for tourists to know that if you really are seeking an experience where you can look to a hard line between something that you think that won't contribute towards elephant abuse or training in any way, you'll probably want to seek experiences that offer observation only. So this brings me to one experience that I had in Thailand that you actually heard the last clip from.
Oh, yeah.
It was a place called Elephant Valley in Chiang Rai, close to Chiang Mai, Thailand, in the northern part of the country. And this is a place where their five elephants were previously in the logging and trekking camp industry. And now they live at this sanctuary where they're able to kind of roam free. They're able to interact with each other. Tourists come in small groups, but tourists cannot get close to them. They can't bathe them. They can't ride them. And what this means is that the elephants can sort of just be elephants. So when you're looking for these sorts of experiences, if that's something you're interested in, you'll want to, we would recommend based on what we found in our reporting, is that observation is something you really want to kind of keep in mind.
And we'd love to hear from you, too. If you've ever been on a vacation to see wild animals in their natural habitat, what was it like? Were you concerned about how the animals were treated? Or if you've changed your tourism habits out of concern for wildlife, what do you do differently now? Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email us 1A@WAMU.org. Natasha, is there a cultural component to this conversation, too? To what extent is this shaped by how different countries view animals and animal rights?
Right. So I think that, you know, a cultural anthropologist would be able to speak to this in depth. So I think I can't necessarily comment on cultural expectations within cultures and explanations for this. But there are a few things that we do know. First of all, we know that over the last 15 years, trips abroad taken by people around the world have doubled. So this industry is growing. But what we also
And how big is it? Let's make that clear. What's the scope here, money-wise?
Right. It's actually really tough to determine. No one really knows. There hasn't been any quantitative analysis of what the financial scale is of the wildlife tourism industry. So hopefully that's something that will continue to be researched in years to come.
Okay.
But what we do know is that this jump in tourists is driven partly by Chinese tourists who are taking twice as many trips abroad as they were, as any other nationality as they were a decade ago. So this is something that we encountered as we visited various tourist attractions. Owners of these camps would frequently tell us that the shows and the rides are desired in large part by their Chinese visitors. So for whatever reason that is, I'm not quite sure, but that's a reality that exists. Something that I think is important to note is that, you know, in China, there aren't any federal animal welfare laws. So that may in some part contribute to possibly a lack of awareness or different attitudes towards the treatment of animals in captivity. So that, and whereas, you know, in the West, there are frequently news stories about animals around the world who may be in conditions that aren't ideal to the reader. And so this is something that pops up and up. So I think that maybe an increased awareness may contribute to the fact that some Western tourists are desiring experiences that are maybe a little more ethical.
Is it wrong to project one's own ethical standards onto other countries? Like, how do we navigate something like that?
You know, it's tough because there aren't any universal standards for these experiences. There is not any body you can turn to that will tell you this place is something, is somewhere where you should go and this place isn't. It's really actually difficult to find those guidelines to sort of tell you what to do and what not to do. I think what is something that we can turn to, they're called the five freedoms. And these are really sort of universally recognized by veterinary bodies in the US and Canada and Europe and around the world as standards through which we should treat animals to mitigate their suffering.
You said the five freedoms?
Yes, they're called the five freedoms. And some examples of the five freedoms are freedom from hunger and thirst, freedom from discomfort, freedom from pain or injury, freedom to express their normal behavior, and freedom from fear and distress. So if you're able to look at these experiences through those lenses, it may help you identify, okay, you know, this experience that I'm researching online doesn't seem like it adheres to the five freedom standards. So that may help you evaluate for yourself which experiences you may want to contribute to. And ultimately, that's what this all comes down to, is people arming themselves with the knowledge of what goes into this industry and being able to identify for themselves what they may want to pay money to contribute to.
Stuart emailed us. He says, why are we targeting so-called exotic animals in the East and not, say, riding horses at a dude ranch in Montana? What's the difference?
Right. So I think that one thing to note is that horses, for example, are domesticated animals. They have been domesticated for, you know, a very, very long time by humans. They're used to interacting with humans. And so the training process to get that horse to, you know, give a person a ride at a dude ranch, for example, is very different from the training process that goes into preparing an elephant for a lifetime of these up-close experiences. So I think that that is one distinction that we want to keep in mind. And that's really why we wanted to look at specifically wild animals in captivity in this reporting, because wild animals specifically undergo various, in many forms, especially in Thailand where we were, training that has to allow them to you know, have these encounters, for example.
In 2017, you reported on a tool that Instagram added to its app to alert users of possible animal abuse. Can you talk about that tool?
Yes. So in 2017, and this is following a story we did in the Amazon, and very quickly what we are looking at in the Amazon was actually wild animals being poached from the jungle illegally for use in the tourism industry. So sloths, caimans, anacondas, et cetera. And after our story ran, Instagram actually responded to they're aware of the fact that these activities are shared through social media. I think that something that's important to keep in mind is that they're not in the business of policing behavior. So their hands are tied when it comes to stopping people from sharing photos of these experiences, especially if they're legal, such as in the case in Thailand. But what they did was they targeted dozens of hashtags associated with wildlife tourism, like sloth selfie, tiger selfie, I believe. Yeah. And so what happens, and still in place, so when you will search an Instagram hashtag sloth selfie, a pop-up will come up on your screen that says something along the lines of, the content you're viewing may be harmful to animals. Click here to learn more. And it takes you to a page in Instagram's help center with lots of information from various NGOs and animal welfare organizations, educating people on what they might want to look for. So this is a great step from Instagram in sort of, you know, approaching this issue on their platform.
But are we seeing these kinds of initiatives elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I think that elsewhere on social media.
Yes.
So as to my knowledge so far, what we've seen to date is this Instagram movement. But I think it'll be interesting to see what happens in the months and years to come, especially now that this issue is so much on the radar, I think, of social media users. It'll be interesting to see how the kind of social media industry responds.
Now, I want to read an email from Matthew. He says, I was in Mexico with my family at a wildlife park, and they wanted to swim with the dolphins. My 14-year-old daughter at the time watched the harnessing and corralling of these mammals and turned to me and said, I don't want to do this anymore. We no longer go to these parks, zoos, or circuses, as the rest of my family agreed it wasn't fun to watch animals forced to entertain. So even a young child was able to see that something wasn't quite right there.
Right. I mean, I think that's really interesting. I think children tend to, based on my experience, tend to have a really keen kind of sense of what something may not feel quite right. And I think that actually raises a really good point that it's so important to trust your gut when you're out there on vacation, especially in a place you may not be familiar with. You may not even speak the language. But if something to you in that circumstance may not feel quite right, then it's important to sort of listen to your intuition.
Now, let's say I'm starting to plan a trip and I go to Google, right, and I'm looking for ethical animal encounters. What should I look for online?
Yeah, so I think it's really important to know that don't necessarily just pay attention to the language used on a website. So if a place calls themselves a sanctuary, okay, that's great. They may be a sanctuary, but they also may not be. In Thailand, for example, there are no sort of regulations in terms of who can call themselves a sanctuary and who can't. That word can be thrown around willy-nilly. So I think that what you really want to do is if you're interested in having these sort of experiences, it's a great place to start. Yeah, Google ethical elephant sanctuary, ethical tiger experience, for example. But then once you get to the attraction's website or their page on TripAdvisor, you may want to look at 1- and 2-star reviews. So often the kind of negative reviews are where animal welfare concerns are detailed. You also want to look at actually the activities that a place offers. If they're offering interaction, that may be a red flag. If they go out of their way to say, we don't offer any interaction, here's why, that may be a good sign if that's something you're interested in. So it's just really, really important to arm yourself with the knowledge.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons. You're listening to 1A. Now, is it possible for any wildlife tourism to be truly ethical if it means animals are being held in captivity? Just sort of on that same thought you were just on. How do you frame the conversation of ethics?
Right. So I don't think that captivity is the problem at all here. There are, for example, with elephants, domesticated elephants, the 3,800 elephants that are in captivity in Thailand cannot be re-released to the wild. These are animals that are now dependent on human care and have to remain in human care. So the concept of wild animals in captivity is maybe not the focus that we want to highlight. What we're really looking for is the treatment of animals in captivity. So again, you can go back to the five freedoms to sort of evaluate experiences through that lens. You can really look at how, when you're there on the ground, look at how these animals animals are being kept. Look if they have social contact with other members of their own species. Look at the space they actually have to roam. That's really important. So I think that, yes, like, we don't want to frame this in the sense that, you know, seeing animals in the wild is good, seeing animals in captivity is bad. That's absolutely not the case. It's more a case-by-case basis. There's a massive spectrum of how animals are treated, and you just want to do your homework.
And just so it's clear, who decides what's ethical? Is there, like, a certification process?
There's not. I mean, that's kind of the big challenge of this. No one decides what's ethical. I mean, I think that if we're looking through what's ethical, looking at what's ethical through the lens of, okay, are we mitigating suffering? And if we put the standard of suffering as sort of our baseline, we don't want to contribute to animal suffering while we're seeking entertainment, then you can use that as your baseline and your approach. And through that, you can evaluate whether that animal is suffering or not, or whether they're thriving. So I think that that's something that the five freedoms really come in handy about, looking for experiences that offer observation, because, again, there's just a huge spectrum. And if you're looking at observation only in a natural sort of habitat, it's likely that that experience may be less likely to cause suffering for that animal.
I want to read an email from Dee. Dee says, there is currently a popular commercial from a financial firm showing an older couple bathing elephants and meeting with their financial advisor to ensure that they can do this every year. Do businesses ever consider what their ads promote other than their products?
I think that's a very important point. That, you know, for example, I think the show Amazing Race recently went to a location where they rode elephants. So, again, this is something that comes down to awareness. I don't think companies and the industry is maybe even necessarily aware that what they're putting in their commercials may be raising these red flags. So, again, this isn't something that just comes down to, you know, travelers need to be aware. I think that the whole, you know, advertising community as a whole needs to be aware. It's something that the more aware people are, the less likely they are to inadvertently promote experiences that may not be ethical.
Right. Now, let's talk about who's doing it well. Like, you know, what were some of the countries that were handling wildlife tourism the best? And where would you tell people to gravitate to when they're looking to plan trips that involve animals? Where specifically?
Right. So I think it's tough to say which countries are doing this best, because I think that these activities go on. There's a spectrum in every country in the world. For example, these tiger experiences I describe in Thailand, they also exist throughout the United States. So this is something that I think what it comes down to is that in many countries, these experiences are legal. And I think that's important for people to know. So often people will say, well, why can't these animals just be rescued? Well, it's because that it's legal and then no one's breaking any laws necessarily. So I think that what people really want to do is be able to tell for yourself, know that your dollars actually change the industry. The entire industry is so entrepreneurial that when consumer demand asks for something new, the industry will follow.
And briefly, you know, National Geographic is also getting involved and raising awareness about this issue. Can you talk about the new social media campaign surrounding wildlife tourism briefly?
Yes. So we've started a hashtag called #NatGeoWildlifeTourism. And we're looking for people to sort of share this one shareable image from our story to raise awareness in their own communities. Because what's so important, this all comes down to people spreading awareness themselves. This movement will live and die on people spreading awareness to their own friends and family. And so I think that getting involved on social media is key.
Natasha Daly is a writer and editor for National Geographic, covering animal welfare and exploitation. What's next for you?
I'm not sure yet. That's a really good question.
Sky's the limit, right? Natasha, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We just heard about how tigers are in particularly high demand these days, but danger to the species doesn't just come from the tourism industry. Coming up, we'll talk about another threat facing tigers with conservationist and wildlife photographer Carl Amon. He has quite the story to tell. Stay with us. You're listening to 1A. This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, in for Joshua Johnson. Over the last century, the number of tigers living in the wild has plummeted from around 100,000 to fewer than 4,000. There are now more tigers living in captivity than there are living in the wild. And the life for those in captivity should concern us all. Many tigers are being bred and then butchered and sold for parts or on tiger farms that turn major profits. Swedish conservationist and wildlife photographer Carl Amon has spent years tracking tiger butchers who run these farms. He was recently profiled by the Washington Post in the midst of trying to expose prominent traffickers who operate farms in Laos. And he joins us now from Nanyuki, Kenya. Carl, it's great to have you on 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Can you talk about the system behind these operations? Who's running them? How do they get the tigers, and who's protecting these farms?
There are different operations in essentially different countries. I mean, in Laos, there are really tiger farms, which are not disguised as anything else, but they will go now to the next step and declaring them zoos to make them more acceptable and legal. In Thailand, they have been essentially classified as zoos with zoo licenses for many years. But at the end of the day, a lot of the adult tigers disappear out the back door. So it amounts to tiger farming to some extent as well. In China, you have some very big tiger farms, again, disguised as some kind of conservation project, implying that they can be introduced, which has never reintroduced, which has never been done successfully. So in different parts of Southeast Asia, the patterns are slightly different, and the people behind it are people who know how to make money, how to get patronage from the very top so they can get away with whatever they're doing, breaking the law, bribing, and so on. So that's basically what we have been documenting for the last few years.
And who's protecting these farms?
As at the patronage, I mean, the people who protect the farms in case of Laos, the former prime minister is regularly being said to be somebody who is, backing the owners up. And if there's any problems, they can call on him to sort problems out. And also the president of Laos has been implicated in this context.
Right. And that reaches into my next question. In Laos, these farms are illegal, but no one's been arrested. On the outside, at least, it appears as though the government has tried to intervene in recent years, ordering tiger farms and merchandise shops to close. Has this made any difference at all?
There has been very limited enforcement. I mean, in some shops, enforcement officials have gone in and confiscated some ivory or rhino horn products. But as you said, to the best of my knowledge, nobody has ever been prosecuted or ended up spending a day in jail. It's not considered a serious issue, the wildlife trade. And in Laos, it involves also players which are heavily involved in the ivory trade, in importing lion bones from South Africa, which are then sold as tiger bones. So, it goes across a widespread spectrum of wildlife species which are traded by these dealers.
Carl, let's talk more about your investigation into these tiger farms. Where did you go? And were you prepared for danger that might come your way?
Look, some of the stuff I can do myself, and I have done myself, but most of the time I have to use local operatives, people who speak the language, equip them with hidden camera, send them off, have them come back, see what happened, how the questions they have been asked to ask were answered, and then for more questions, send them back maybe a few months later to round out the picture. But myself, only on this last trip did I manage to get into one of these tiger farms, which has now been converted as a zoo and is now open to the public, except nothing has changed. The speed breeding is still going on, and it's factory farming at the end of the days, and the tigers at 3 years of age are butchered for their body parts.
What do these farms actually look like? Can you describe?
Okay. We have some pretty good drone images, which show just rows and rows of cages, a central corridor in the middle for, the servicing part of it, the feeding, the cleaning out, an outdoor enclosure of maybe 4x4 meter, and maybe 200 tigers in one of these facilities, and there are about three or four in Laos alone. But as I said, in China, some of these facilities, I just visited one in Harbin in the north of China, which has 1,000 tigers.
So you find evidence that these tiger farms are very much still in operation, and you even come face to face with a primary wildlife trafficker that you've been seeking out. What do you do with this information?
Okay, I mean, I've been working on this story now for about 8 years as part of a documentary, a feature-length film documentary, but obviously always new stuff happens. More interesting information comes out, footage which we didn't have before. But now we're in the final stages, and that's basically why I have agreed at the time to take the correspondent from the Washington Post along, because now it will become more difficult for me or my local operatives to do what we have been doing. But that's the approach I'm using. If I can get into a place like myself, like I did in Harbin, which is open to the public, then of course I do it. I try to document as much as I can. I know where potentially their weak points are to expose illegal activities, and I have done that. But otherwise, I have to largely rely on local guys. Some of them I've worked with for 10 years or longer.
Okay. Now, the feature-length documentary that you just mentioned, can you give us an idea of when we can expect that? And can you also, are you able to talk about how you'll structure the film? Take us sort of on a journey of what you can share about the film at this stage.
Okay, I mean, it started as an accident. I didn't go out and look for tiger farms. I was with a German film team at a town called Boten, which is one of these, special economic zones on the China-Lao border. It's more China than Lao because everything is in Chinese, the language, the currency, the site, the mobile phone network, it's all Chinese. But the laws of China don't apply, so Chinese visitors can do whatever they can do on their side of the border, be it gambling or prostitution. The drug trade is all very active, and the wildlife trade. So we found two clouded leopard cubs up by the roadside for sale. And while we played with these clouded leopard cubs, a driver for lorry came up and said he knows where there's two tiger cubs for sale. So we said, give us the details. We're interested to follow up. So we did, drove 6 hours. The tiger cubs had been sold. But the woman who had held them obviously knew who had killed the mother, where, when, how, and introduced us to one of the hunters. And from there on, it started following up. We ended up finding out that these tiger cubs had ended up in one of these farms, probably the last wild tigers, which did so because it's very rare to get hold of, wild tiger cubs. And probably, in terms of genetic material, a very valuable pair of tigers. So the film is now in the final editing stage, meaning there's an editor in Switzerland who is full-time working on it, and we hope to have a rough cut by late summer, which we can then take to film festivals and see what the reaction is, if the world is ready for some of the information, if some of the stuff we are showing is too gruesome for the public to deal with, or if the public is ready to say enough is enough.
How graphic will it get? I know you just mentioned about some of the information being too gruesome.
Yeah, okay. I mean, the one component which we have been debating, can we, should we, or shouldn't we include it, is a story of a shop owner, Chinese shop owner in Laos, offering pink tiger bone jewelry. A lot of these items are jewelry items, be it claw teeth, but also the bones are worked into jewelry. In this case, it was pink, and obviously there was next to it, there were bracelets of the normal whitish-yellow bone jewelry. So the question immediately arose, so what's the difference between pink and normal? And then she explained that, these bones have been harvested while the tiger was still alive. And then she showed us pictures on her phone of a tiger lying on the floor being supposedly deboned. I'm not sure if it's mostly a sales gimmick, but we later confirmed it with a tiger farm manager that indeed there is buyers arriving which ask for the tiger to be sedated and then butchered while he's not yet dead, and or she. And the bones supposedly then contain more blood in them because the heart is still pumping. So you come away with pink tiger bones, which are more valuable than the normal tiger bones.
Are you hoping for an international response to this issue once the film is shown?
Look, I mean, there is an international response in the sense that the CITES Convention, which regulates cross-border international trafficking, and a lot of this, what we're talking about, is international. People in Laos don't buy this stuff. It goes into Vietnam and China mostly. That's where the end consumers are. So there's a decision by CITES, which all the parties have agreed to, 1469 it's called, that nobody will breed tigers for commercial purposes if there's no conservation value to it. So all these operations are infringing on an international law, on an international convention, so it already exists.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons. You're listening to 1A. Now, Carl, according to the Washington Post's profile of you, you've engaged in many of these risky types of investigations before. Why do you put your life at risk and spend so much money?
Look, I'm not sure if I'm putting my life at risk. It's not as risky and dangerous as maybe some people, you know, would might believe. But as I said, my local operatives are generally taking more risks than I do, and I discuss it with them, and they agree to it. And I do spend my own money on it. I just feel I like wildlife. I've lived in nature here in Kenya. I've enjoyed nature and ecosystems and wildlife for the last 40 years in this part of the world. And I just find it horrible that some of these things are allowed to go on, and that, you know, I just can't accept to live with it. So if I can expose it and take away the excuse of I did not know from policymakers, but also concerned individuals, then, you know, it's up to all these people to decide, can we live with it, or does something have to change? What can I personally do? And that's basically what it's all about, in my opinion.
Do you think, though, that one person can impact the future of ecology?
I don't think one person can. And I mean, after the Washington Post story, I must have had 30, 40 emails asking me, what can I do? And the general thing is to write a check. But I don't believe writing checks at the moment or in this stage where we're in is going to solve anything. So, no, it's very difficult for an individual to really make a change. But, you know, if the kids in UK go into the street or around the world nowadays for global warming, there can be waves of, people deciding enough is enough, and let me voice my opinion. They're taxpayers, they're voters, so maybe the politician and policymakers will have to take it seriously at some point.
I want to throw in an email from Leslie. She writes, how can we support Carl's work? How can one support you?
I've had this question dozens of times, and I said I do what I do with my own funds, so sending me donations is not what I'm looking for. But on the other hand, the individual, I have suggested to some of these people, they go to Harbin, this tiger farm in the north, which is open to tourism. You can buy tiger wine through a store in the back of the facility. You can count the tigers. You can ask questions via translator and say, go back home and do what you can. Go onto your Facebook page, use social media, write to your local newspaper, and create the kind of awareness which, at the end of the day, is best hope to make a difference.
What other conservation efforts are you working on?
At the moment, it's something quite similar in a sense that it's again involving Laos and China. They have been trafficking of live elephants for quite some time, again under the CITES Convention, illegal. One of these shipments was stopped of 16 elephants on the way to Dubai to a safari park. The Emirates Airlines 747 was already standing on the ground when the Prime Minister finally intervened and stopped it the night before their departure. But as I said, we know of probably 100 or more elephants having gone into China. We are documenting their life quality in China at the moment and, trying again to create awareness. Look, this is not, this is exploitation of wildlife for monetary gain only and is illegal under the CITES Convention.
A new report released by the UN says 1 million plant and animal species now face extinction. What other species aside from tigers are you worried about in particular, Carl?
Look, I mean, there's a lot going on, but as I said, in the context of the demand from Southeast Asia, I've been calling it a funnel sucking up the wild's biodiversity. I mean, it goes from sea cucumbers to seahorses to, obviously, we have heard all about the pangolin. We all know about the elephants. We all know about the rhino horn, the demand. We know about these tiger products. So when you go into a traditional Chinese medicine store or in a big area where these products are for sale, you find hundreds of species in large quantities, turtles as well, and you wonder how sustainable can this be? How long can this last, this demand and supply? And I think we haven't scratched the surface yet of how much is really traded and the impact it has upon the remaining wild populations.
Well, we'll certainly look forward to your feature-length documentary when that does come out. Carl Amon is a conservationist and wildlife photographer based in Nanyuki, Kenya. Carl, thanks for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.
Remember, you can connect with us about upcoming episodes and debates online at the1a.org and click on Ask 1A. That's the word the, the number one, the letter A, .org, and click Ask 1A. Today's conversation was produced by Catherine Fink. To learn more about her and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.